the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Syria says Israel has fired missiles toward the Damascus countryside for the second time in the past few days. A Republican winning the race for governor in the U.S. state of Virginia, and a setback for President Biden ahead of next year's congressional elections. Also ahead, fishing dispute in the English Channel far from resolved. The U.K. standing firm on its stance while talks with France continue. Welcome to the program. Syrian media say the Israeli military has carried out a missile attack on an area near the capital, Damascus. Still no word on possible damage or casualties caused by the attack. The strike comes less than a week after Syrian air defenses intercepted missiles over the same area. Israeli regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, despite the country's repeated calls for action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Activist and political commentator Ken Stone says Israel's Western supporters embolden it to violate international law by allowing it to attack Syria with impunity.
Israel continues to do this in violation of international law because it has powerful backers which enable it to attack Syria, to overfly the sovereign territory of Lebanon, to mistreat the Palestinian people. And these enablers are to be found in Washington, in Ottawa, in London, in Paris, all the Western capitals. The reason that they allow this to go on in Syria is because even though their regime change attempt in Syria failed after 10 years, the U.S. coalition, which includes Canada, France, UK, and Israel, is trying now to prevent Syria from getting back on its feet and reconstructing itself.
It's election night in the U.S. with multiple polls underway in several key states, including the gubernatorial races in Virginia and New Jersey. Virginia Republican Glenn Youngkin is set to win the race against his Democratic rival Terry McAuliffe. New Jersey Republican Jack Ciattarelli is holding a lead over incumbent Democratic rival Governor Phil Murphy. Meanwhile, mayoral races are also ongoing in several cities, including Atlanta, Boston, and Pittsburgh. The New York City has elected Democrat Eric Adams as its new mayor. The polls are, in fact, putting the presidency of Joe Biden to test ahead of next year's midterm elections. Now, the UK says its stance on the fishing row with France has not changed despite a relative easing of tensions between the two neighbors. Speaking to reporters in Glasgow, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson dismissed the feud as, quote, vanishingly unimportant. Paris and London are in talks to resolve the fishing dispute. On Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron delayed sanctions against the UK. Paris threatened London with restrictions last week after Britain insisted on barring French fishermen from British waters. London argues that a fisherman lacks sufficient paperwork, but France accuses Britain of breaching a post-Brexit trading arrangement regarding fishing rights.
The United Kingdom and France have gotten into a bitter diplomatic row. The two countries have been at odds over post-Brexit fishing rights in the British territorial waters. The UK gives out licenses to foreign vessels wishing to fish in its waters, but Paris says some fishing boats have been denied permission to enter areas they have fished in for years. London says the licenses have been distributed according to the post-Brexit deal it reached with the European Union last December. The dispute escalated to the point where a British trawler was seized by French officials, prompting the UK to summon Paris's ambassador in London, a move that's usually made against enemies and not allies. Paris threatened London with sanctions if the issue isn't resolved by the 2nd of November. The UK Foreign Secretary launched a counterattack against France, vowing legal action if Paris doesn't back down.
Well, France has made completely unacceptable threats, first of all to our fishermen, but also to the Channel Islands in terms of their energy supply. And we need them to withdraw those threats. If they don't withdraw those threats, we are prepared to use the dispute resolution mechanism in the trade deal we signed with the EU to take action against the French.
It's unclear. It's always unclear as to who is correct or incorrect, but usually they are resolved in a peaceful, diplomatic manner. But we live in an age of a growing nationalism in which international institutions are breaking down. And so as a result, a minor spat over fishing rights is turning into a major international crisis.
The threats have raised concerns about a larger trade dispute between two of Europe's largest economies.
Since the Brexit referendum 5 years ago, the UK has been facing a multitude of challenges and uncertainties. Those include the complications for freedom of movement, the Northern Ireland border, and not so least of all, the economy. A fuel shortage last month in Britain was one instance suggesting the extent of the ramifications for the country. How is London trying to address these issues? And is the Brexit deal with the EU enough to avert future disputes? Take a look.
The fishing issue was one of the key points dragging the Brexit talks. Although fishing constitutes a small portion of France and Britain's economies, it holds substantial political significance as it's the main lifeline for the coastal communities. Apart from the fishing disputes, the two countries have recently clashed over the AUKUS agreement, under which Australia ditched a multi-billion-dollar submarine deal with France for a similar one with the US and UK.
So it's a the French were appalled, extremely angry by America's peremptory behavior, and they are looking for a way of striking back. And Boris Johnson didn't make things any better by taunting the French during the AUKUS alliance became news, by taunting them in the crudest schoolboy manner.
Britain's departure from the EU has also negatively affected its economy. Official data forecast a 4% economic slowdown for the country in the long run in the aftermath of its exit from the bloc, while the COVID-19 impact is estimated to cut Britain's gross domestic product by 2%. Brexit also cast doubts on the future of the 1998 Irish peace deal, as it would mean a hard border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. although the two sides settled the issue, the agreement that has been implemented since January this year has led to the disruption of trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, causing disagreements between London and Brussels. The UK government now wants the deal rewritten. Experts believe the long lines and brawls at the fuel stations across Britain are going to be the new normal for life in the post-Brexit UK.
The rift deepening between France and Australia over a collapsed submarine deal. Paris is now accusing Canberra of deliberately deceiving the French by abandoning the deal.
The deceit was intentional. And because there was far more at stake than providing submarines, because it was a common agreement on sovereignty, sealed with the transmission of highly classified data, the way it was handled was plainly a stab in the back.
The French ambassador also questioned Australia's commitment to its partner, saying the way it acted was not befitting France. The envoy was addressing the National Press Club after returning to Canberra. It was recalled to Paris in September over the spat. The Australian Prime Minister was quick to dismiss the accusations. Scott Morrison's stance has been that the deal did not serve Canberra's strategic interests. Australia terminated the $90 billion submarine contract with France and instead opted for a trilateral security partnership with the United States and Britain. Paris was angered by the move and later recalled its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. It's been 104 years since British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his infamous declaration giving Israeli settlers the permission to usurp Palestinian land. Ashraf Shannon has filed a report.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then-British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for their pain and suffering for more than seven decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Well, Palestinian families facing eviction from Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood reject a deal requiring them to recognize Israeli settlers' ownership of their lands.
We, the families of Sheikh Jarrah, rejected the compromise offered to us by the Court of the Occupation, which considers us as protected tenants renting from the settler organization of Nahalat Shimon, and which will lead to the confiscation of our rights in our lands. We reject because we believe in our cause and our right to our home and country. Despite that, we are not getting any guarantees to support our steadfastness as Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem from any side or organization.
The family slammed the deal as unjust, stressing their right to their homes and their homeland. They accused Tel Aviv of forcing them to choose between their own disposition or submitting to an oppressive agreement. In October, Israel's Supreme Court proposed that the Palestinian families remain in their homes for 15 years while paying rent to settlers who have claimed the land. The court gave them until November the 2nd to decide whether to accept. The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has been at the heart of crackdowns on protests against the planned expulsion of Palestinian families in favor of Israeli settlers. And now Lebanon has invited Saudi Arabia to dialogue to ease recent tensions between the two nations or countries. Analysts, however, believe that the issue is not merely about those statements made by the Lebanese information minister over his remarks critical of the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
With the socioeconomic crisis deepening in Lebanon, the Saudi regime is not making things any easier. Riyadh's reaction to comments by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi, who had decried the Saudi war on Yemen, is a stick being used against the Lebanese government. The main question is, will he step down?
Concerning Mr. Kordahi, it is obvious now that he is not going to resign because he is not resembling himself. He is resembling a huge national bloc that is backing him because it's a matter of the Lebanese dignity here. We are not going to let the Saudis succeed in their blackmailing moves against Lebanon.
But analysts believe the Saudi Crown Prince is trying to get concessions from Lebanon in return for funding the economic reform plan.
Saudi Crown Prince is trying to make use of the economic crisis taking place in Lebanon to put pressure on the Lebanese to make some concessions regarding his influence inside Lebanon. And here there is some kind of intersection between the Saudis and the Israelis because the target is the resistance in Lebanon.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib told Agence France-Presse that he had invited the Saudis to the negotiating table in a bid to solve all the outstanding problems. Saudi Arabia is an Arab country, he said, which has historic brotherly ties with Lebanon, but then severed diplomatic ties without holding any talks. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati is also holding talks with other Arab states in COP20 in Glasgow to see whether the diplomatic row can be eased. Now, observers say it all has to do with how the Americans deal with the Saudis.
The main issue is between Riyadh and Washington. Once the situation between Washington and Riyadh is solved, I think the crisis will be solved in Lebanon. And the pressure the Saudis are exerting on Lebanon is going to soften. But up till now, it seems that Mikati is having the backing of Washington and Paris because, as I said, they both want this government to remain.
While the crisis resulting from Minister Kordahi's statements remains high, the Saudis themselves have declared that their campaign against Lebanon is a much bigger issue. Their ultimate goal in the last couple of decades seemed to have been detaching Hezbollah from the Lebanese political scene. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Thank you. supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Almost a third of Republicans believe violence may be necessary to solve the problems the United States is facing today, according to a new national survey. The poll by the nonprofit Public Religion Research Institute released recently finds that 30% of Republicans agree with the statement because things have gotten so far off track. True American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, unquote. The findings are reflective of the continued impact of the post-presidential election events that fueled the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Adam Gabbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Almost 1 in 3 of Republicans Say Violence May Be Necessary to Save the U.S. Stay tuned for more. Troubling statistics show the post-election rancor that led to the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th is still very much in place. Almost a third of Republicans believe violence may be necessary to save the U.S., according to a new poll.
Researchers at the Public Religion Research Institute, a nonprofit, found that 30% of Republicans agreed with the statement because things have gotten so far off track. True American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, unquote. Among Americans who believe the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, 39% believe violence may be required. The troubling statistics show the post-election rancor that led to the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th is still very much in place. Republicans are most likely to believe true American patriots may have to resort to violence. PRRI found, with just 11% of Democrats and 17% of independents agreeing with the statement. Among all Americans, 18% agreed. PRRI said 2,508 adults living in all 50 states were interviewed for the survey between 16th and 29th of September. It is an alarming finding, Robert Jones, chief executive and founder of PRRI, told Yahoo News, adding, "I have been doing this a while, for decades, and it's not the kind of finding that a sociologist, a public opinion pollster that you're used to seeing." Jones said the responses illustrate the significant and rapidly increasing polarization in the United States. Jones said, "As we have gotten some distance from the January 6th attacks, one might hope cooler heads would prevail, but we really haven't seen that. If anything, it looks like people are doubling down and views are getting kind of locked in." The PRRI poll is not the first to discover an apparent readiness for violence among Republican voters. In February, a survey by the American Enterprise Institute found that 39% of Republicans thought that if elected leaders will not protect America, the people must do it themselves, even if it requires violent actions. Among all Americans, 29% agreed with that statement. Some, 31% of independent voters and 17% of Democrats, thought violent action might be required. More than 650 people have been criminally charged for their role in the Capitol attack, in which 5 people died. Trump is resisting attempts to investigate from a House Select Committee, most recently suing the National Archives to stop the release of White House documents.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Communique.
Snipers belonging to the Lebanese forces militia opened fire at a peaceful protest led by Hezbollah and Amal protesters. In the mainstream media, they've called them clashes. Many Lebanese accuse them of purposely hiding or obfuscating the identities of the victims and even of blaming Hezbollah for the violence. So were these just clashes, as some in the media have suggested, or something more sinister aimed at provoking a reaction from Hezbollah an escalation and dragging Lebanon into a civil war. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. October 14th, seven people were martyred and dozens more wounded after snipers opened fire at protesters in Beirut's Tayuna district. The majority of the victims, supporters of Hezbollah and its ally, the Amal movement, who'd gathered outside the Palace of Justice. Intended as a peaceful, unarmed protest, Hezbollah called for the demonstration the day before to protest against a judge named Tariq Bitar, who people accuse of politicizing the investigation into the Beirut port explosion. Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar reported that the American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, was attempting to frame Hezbollah for the explosion and influence the investigation. As protesters gathered outside the Palace of Justice, sniper fire began to erupt as gunmen on the surrounding buildings began firing at the protesters from rooftops and other vantage points. After the violence erupted, the armed wings of these groups then arrived with weapons to defend the protesters. And I think this is a very important point to understand, because some people in the Western mainstream media and Lebanese media have referred to the massacre as a clash, implying an exchange of fire between two sides. But is that really how things went down? Because when snipers start shooting at protesters, that's an ambush. It's an attack. It's not a clash, which would require both sides to be fighting from the start. Now, some people have also posted videos online saying, look, you see, the protesters were armed. Hezbollah and Amal, they brought weapons to the protest. They asked for it. But this is, again, untrue. One of the martyrs was a mother waiting at the window for her children to come home from school. She wasn't even at the protest, let alone carrying a weapon. How do you explain her death? The demonstration that took place was live-streamed. There are tons of videos and photographs showing very clearly that no one was armed. You can see here, as the shooting begins, there isn't a single weapon in the entire shot. The videos of people carrying weapons are from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed protesters. It's only then that people came from nearby districts in order to defend the protesters. So that's a completely different story and a very important distinction to make. All the victims had head wounds, indicating a clear intent to kill. Not to deter, nor disperse, nor defend, or whatever other excuse the apologists for this massacre have concocted. The Lebanese army even put out a tweet confirming that protesters had been shot at. They didn't say that armed groups or personnel were shot at. They said protesters. The Minister of Interior also confirmed that this was indeed a massacre, an ambush, and not some clash. Of course, some people in the media, they don't even want to disclose the identity of the victims. Hezbollah is always the bad guy, according to them. So when Hezbollah supporters are being massacred in broad daylight, this runs counter to their usual narrative. And if you look at the various headlines in the press, you can see how they use this passive language to avoid telling the truth. If you read their headlines, you would never know what actually happened and who was shot at. So they're basically lying about what happened, either calling it a clash or trying to obfuscate the identity of the victims. And we know that the victims are mostly Hezbollah and Amal supporters. So what about the perpetrators? Who was behind the attack? Well, the Lebanese army has so far arrested a total of 19 people in connection with the attack. It is widely assumed that a right-wing Christian militia and a rival of Hezbollah, known as the Lebanese Forces, they were behind the massacre. And if you knew anything about the history of the Lebanese Forces and the history of their leader, Samir Jaja, this would hardly surprise you. As a matter of fact, this recent attack pales in comparison with their other atrocities when they killed scores of Christians, Muslims, Palestinians, Armenians. Not only that, but during the Lebanese Civil War, the Lebanese Forces militia committed treason and collaborated with Israel, an invading and occupying force, to carry out these attacks. They received funding, clothing, and weapons from the Israelis. And in September 1982, together, they committed one of the most horrific massacres, murdering 3,500 Palestinians and Lebanese Shia in Beirut. The leader of the Lebanese Forces militia, Samir Jaja, was also found guilty of assassinating the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rashid Karami, in 1987, and Danish Namoun in 1990. Today, Jaja also enjoys funding and support from Saudi Arabia and the United States, who have a vested interest in fracturing Lebanon and weakening Hezbollah. One of the victims, Mohammed Tamir, is reported to have been killed, not by the Lebanese Forces militia, but actually by the Lebanese army. The authenticity of CCTV footage posted online appeared to be confirmed when the Lebanese army said that the soldier in question is now under investigation. The scenes of this latest massacre in Beirut are a painful reminder to many of Lebanon's civil war, which lasted 15 years and took place on these very streets. It is with that in mind that Hezbollah and Amal released an official statement following the shooting, asking people to remain calm and refrain from retaliating to the murders, for fear of escalating the situation and dragging Lebanon into another civil war, which is perhaps what Jaja and his backers would very much like to do. To discuss more, I'm joined by Zainab El-Safar. She's an Iraqi-Lebanese journalist and the host of the television program Min Al-Dakhil, which airs weekly on El Mayadin. First of all, let me say thank you, Zainab, for coming on the program. It's great to finally have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So, Zainab, can you perhaps just walk us through what happened yesterday in Beirut? First of all, why were people outside? What were they protesting against? Who was protesting? And what is really the issue at hand?
At the night before, the eve before, there were certain kind of suspicious movements in the neighborhoods facing the place that the events took place yesterday. And this is something very suspicious because, you know, when such kind of movements, mobilizations take place by people in black, and they are trying to secure certain kind of neighborhoods, avenues, and streets, and they were trying to deploy their militias over there, and the security forces and the various security forces, they didn't move an eye to all this kind of movement. We have to ask questions and we have to pose questions as, where is the preemptive security that ought to be there at certain points in time? So the next day, the people who were on the streets, let me just tell you and walk you through the events that took place. It is in repercussion to the politicizing of the judge that is in charge of the probe of the Beirut blast that occurred last year on the 4th of August. This particular judge, this unfortunately, we tend to call them justice, but there is no justice in what they are doing. His measures are so discretionary and politicized to the sense that he wanted to deviate the probe from its ultimate aims. And he issued certain kind of subpoenas and orders that were really so suspicious. They were highly politicized. There is no kind of justice or order in whatever he was doing. So the people took to the streets, civilians, unarmed, peaceful demonstrators, people who belong to the elite of Lebanon, lawyers, engineers, teachers, they took to the streets and they were unarmed. Okay, so what happened is that the moment they took to the streets at 10:45 a.m. exactly, fire, sniper fire, heavy, a salvo of sniper fire were started to shoot in their direction. We had seven martyrs, among them a woman, Maryam Farhat. She's the mother of five. I cannot just put them into words and say what has happened. It's like a kind of dragging the people. The events, you know, if you just want to paint the picture, they were so much reminiscent of what took place, what instigated the Lebanese civil war back in 1975. The place and the way the events were taking place and escalating. 4 hours of intense gunfire, incessant gunfire. What does that mean? And nothing happened to stop them.
Yeah, when you mention this poor woman who was killed in her home and, you know, the protesters were unarmed, I mean, this is a very important point because you have a lot of people posting videos, people online saying that the protesters were armed, that they came to the protest with weapons. Is that true? Or were those videos from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed some of the protesters in front of the Palace of Justice?
Unfortunately, Richard, a lot of media outlets, local media outlets and foreign media outlets, are accomplices in the crime that took place against the people, the innocent people of demonstration. The way they were trying to promote that this matter has boiled down into clashes. Clashes take place between two sides. But this is, you know, the Lebanese forces, militias, those lunatic mercenaries. performing, perpetrating this massacre, this intended, pre-planned, pre-orchestrated, and perpetrated massacre against civilians. They were trying to show that the matter is only a kind of clashes, you know, an action and a reaction. No way. Nobody. We said and we underscored the fact that those protesters were unarmed and were peaceful, and they were from the elite, as I said. Those people, they shot at a demonstration, demonstrators, they shot back, and there was an exchange of fire. This was not the case at all. Only the army, you know, deployed, and they deployed their armored personnel, and they were trying to take hold of the situation, 4 hours of intense fire, until they tried to apprehend those perpetrators, and 8 of them are apprehended, and they said that, well, they admitted what they were doing.
What did you make of not just local commentators, but international media portraying it as, you know, a fight between two sides and omitting the victims, that they're Hezbollah and Amal supporters, from the headlines, the subheadings, you know, it just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of, you know, it's part also of the whole choir of trying to show that, well, you know, it's the beginning, the flames of a civil war that is has just erupted and is going to burn Lebanon. It's between a Christian side, you know, and even in the geography, Ain al-Rumani, you say Christian side populated by the Christians, and then you say Ash-Shi'a Hantayuni, it's populated by the Shia mostly, and you say that, well, it's a kind of civil war between the Christians and the Shia, Amal and Hezbollah. They represent the greatest number of Shia in Lebanon, but this was not that, and this is what they want to sell, because, you know, as we all know, that Hezbollah has a very deep-rooted alliance with the Free Patriotic Movement, which is one of the biggest Christian parties in Lebanon, and also Amal Movement has also alliance with the Merida. Hezbollah has also with the Merida. They are all Christians, and they are also people who suffered from the massacres perpetrated by the Lebanese forces against their own people, the Christians, their fellow Christians themselves. The Lebanese forces, party and militia, what they were doing is what they have always been doing, what they are used to be doing. They are mercenaries in the hands of those who pay the higher bid. You know, they are funded by certain Arab regimes, and they take the orders from the Americans, and they perpetrate massacres. We don't, it does not escape us ever, you know, what happened in Sabra and Shatila, and who was responsible for what happened in Sabra and Shatila, where 3,500 people, innocent Palestinians and Lebanese, at least 80 people from Al-Muqdat family, they have been assassinated in a mode which is, they have been butchered. Women, children, elderly, they have been butchered in the Sabra neighborhood, just adjacent to the Shatila refugee camp.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Lebanese army, they arrested members of this Christian militia, the Lebanese forces, for this attack. But it's not really out of place for them, is it? I mean, they have a whole history of this barbarism, let's call it what it is, this barbarism against all various walks of life in Lebanon, as you mentioned. And I think it's really important for people to understand what they are. You know, it's really astonishing for me that someone like Zsa Zsa is a free man. It's really unconscionable, isn't it?
Yes, he was given amnesty back in 2005, and then you know how events escalated back in 2005 with the assassination of the slain Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and then how Lebanon went into this kind of, you know, those events that the aim and target of which was to target the resistance in Lebanon. Then you had 2006, which is the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. But, you know, whoever stood in the face of the resistance has always been defeated. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is part and parcel of the fabric. It is a community. It has a large swathe of constituency. And we have to understand something, speaking of constituency, is that we are very soon approaching the elections in Lebanon, the parliamentary elections. And whatever we see, any kind of instability, any kind of events, is going to be in order to try and tip the balance of elections, because the Lebanese forces, they know for sure that, you know, former member of parliament Waleed Jumblatt is no longer allying with them in Baabda and Ashouf, and he said so clearly. And also Al-Hariri, which is the future bloc, is not aligned with them in the Akkar region, in the Hirmil, and somewhere else. So they are, according to this new electoral law, they'll be losing a lot of seats in the forthcoming elections. And whatever they have done, Richard, they opened their own fire at themselves. This is not something that is going to pass easily. The blood of the martyrs is not going to stay on the streets. There's going to be a kind of accountability, a solid accountability, a vendetta also, not only from those particular people, the way, you know, those people who were also responsible for the events that took place in Khaldi and the killing, the cold blood killing of the people in Khaldi, and those who were also the next day in the funeral procession. Their masters, who are the servants of another master, which is a master that was and is always defeated today, defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq, defeated in Syria, defeated elsewhere, is also going to be defeated in Lebanon, Richard, sooner rather than later.
Zainab, when you speak of their masters, this is a very important point. What role do the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, what role do they play in this attack and in Lebanese politics in general? Is it true, for example, that the Lebanese forces militia was training in Saudi Arabia? You know, what else is the American embassy, what role does the American ambassador play in all this? And what goal are they trying to achieve here? You mentioned destabilizing the elections as one example. Is this also part of a plan to weaken the axis of resistance, to disarm Hezbollah? What about Lebanon's gas and natural resources?
Of course, everything that the Americans have been doing in the region and also in Lebanon in particular, the sanctions against Lebanon, the sanctions against lots of personalities who are allied with the resistance in Lebanon, it's a mode of trying to weaken the resistance in Lebanon and trying to turn the people of Lebanon, the people of the resistance, against their own resistance. And, you know, the American ambassador has been doing all this witchcraft, if I might say, all these kind of suspicious and all these kind of, you know, the imperial moves trying to control Lebanon and the Lebanese institutions, but she's failing. And, you know, the moment Hezbollah tried to get the ship of fuel from Iran, the next day she said that, well, we're going to get gas from Egypt through Syria. Syria that was sanctioned by the very Americans through the Caesar law. They broke the Caesar law, and, you know, and she was reprimanded by her administration, saying that, well, you don't need this Sayyid Nasrallah to do something, and then you have to retaliate the next day to show that you are strong and flexing your muscles. But anyways, she is doing her best. She is on the line of the Pompeo recommendations, still trying to, in her dreams, she dreams a lot that she dreams of disbanding and disarming Hezbollah and, you know, dismantling this kind of party and the people of it, and turning the people of the resistance and the quote-unquote Shia against Hezbollah. Well, this is just in your dreams. These are chimeras, and this is something that can never be true. Regarding the fact that we heard yesterday a very important statement by the mother of the martyr, Maryam Farhat, in yesterday's events, in the massacre that took place yesterday. She said, well, they are not going to move us one iota against the resistance. We know those scenarios. We know the play, this theatrical thing that is taking place against us. We know the ultimate aims of, and we're not going to move. That's why the people of Lebanon yesterday, and I say the people of Lebanon, the true, honest people of Lebanon, they were not being dragged to a kind of civil war, to a kind of sedition, to a kind of discord, because whatever took place, it's not so much strange to us. We know these scenarios, and nobody can drag us again to a civil war.
Zainab El-Safar, thank you so much for your time. It's really a pleasure having your insightful knowledge and graceful presentation on the program. Really great speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
In order to understand the Tayuni massacre that just took place in Beirut, we have to understand the general context of Lebanon's political situation. As we've covered before on the program, Lebanon is under a de facto U.S. siege, its economy in turmoil, and as such, Lebanon remains a very fragile nation in need of political reform. As of recently, Hezbollah has been importing shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon, defying not only U.S. sanctions, but also its political rivals inside the country, making them look weak and incompetent as Hezbollah bolsters its image and popularity with the Lebanese people. There are elections coming up soon in Lebanon, and political parties like Jaja's Lebanese forces want to manipulate public opinion against Hezbollah because of their weak standing and the recent political humiliations that they suffer. External actors like the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have been trying to dismantle Hezbollah for a long time, especially after Hezbollah successfully liberated South Lebanon from Israeli occupation and drove the Israeli invaders back in 2006. The aim of the Tayuni massacre was twofold. One, murdering its supporters to try and provoke Hezbollah into retaliation. The United States, Israel, and Hezbollah's rivals in Lebanon want to paint Hezbollah not as a resistance group, but as some violent armed gang. They want to paint it as an organization that uses violence against its own people so they can try and disarm the group. That way, Hezbollah's political rivals can ascend to power inside Lebanon. The Israelis would no longer face any resistance if they attack or invade Lebanon and Syria. And the United States can go on funding Takfiri terrorists in the region and invading the Middle East with less opposition. So the first aim was to vilify Hezbollah, try and disarm them. The second aim of this massacre was to create sectarian tensions and plunge Lebanon into civil war. Hezbollah and Amal decided not to do either of those things, hence preventing the country from descending into chaos. Let us be clear, everyone has weapons in Lebanon. The difference, however, between the fascist Lebanese forces militia and Hezbollah is that Hezbollah never turns its guns on its own people. It uses them to defend Lebanon from foreign invaders and colonizers. Hezbollah is an integral part of the Axis of Resistance and is allied with Syria, Iran, and the popular mobilization forces in Iraq. So let's examine the events of the past week, because in Syria was bombed twice by Israel and the United States, who struck locations in Homs, south of the ancient, the beautiful city of Palmyra, killing one Syrian soldier and wounding three others. In Afghanistan, two suicide bombers struck mosques in Kunduz and Kandahar during Friday prayers, leaving over 100 people wounded or killed, most of the victims Shia Muslims of the Hazara ethnic minority. And then finally in Lebanon, this tragic massacre with snipers firing at peaceful protesters, again, most of them Shia Muslims and supporters of the resistance. All these things point to a concerted effort by the West and its regional allies to destabilize Lebanon, to provoke sectarian violence and start a civil war. They want to pit Muslims against Christians, Shia against Sunni, and destroy the multi-ethnic, multi-religious fabric of Lebanon. Amal and Hezbollah supporters were specifically targeted by fascists who have a long history of murder, and the mainstream media are trying to downplay this and hide it from them. But this plan of theirs to turn people against one another, to weaken Lebanon's security and weaken the Axis of Resistance, is not going to work. Their intent was clear from the beginning, and this is precisely why Hezbollah and Amal told people not to retaliate. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight. The COP26 climate summit is at serious risk of failure because countries are still not promising enough to restrict global temperature rises to below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Peter Walker, Rowena Mason and Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled COP26 Summit at Serious Risk of Failure, says Boris Johnson. The COP26 climate summit is at serious risk of failure because countries are still not promising enough to restrict global temperature rises to below 1.5 degrees Celsius, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned. In a blunt admission after 2 days of preliminary talks at the G20 meeting of world leaders in Italy, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson conceded little progress had been made, and a conference is not on track to achieve a deal that keeps the goal alive. He put the chances of success at 6 out of 10. Currently, let's be in no doubt, we're not going to hit it, and we have to be honest with ourselves, he said. The commitments being made so far were a drop in the rapidly warming ocean. Boris Johnson set out the scale of the challenge facing humanity as he opened the COP26 Leaders Summit on Monday, 1st of November, attended by almost 200 national representatives, including US President Joe Biden and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, but missing key players such as the Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. He told gathered leaders that the world is at 1 minute to midnight in terms of keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, with the United Nations predicting a rise of 2.7 degrees Celsius under current trajectory, which would lead to catastrophic consequences. He gave his assessment after meetings with G20 leaders at a gathering in Rome, Italy, where he said their progress on climate change had only inched forward. Only 12 of the gathered leaders have pledged to reach net zero emissions by or around 2050. Several key nations, China and Saudi Arabia among them, are only formally pledging to meet that goal by 2060. Britain is also hoping for tougher pledges from countries for 2030, with experts warning emissions need to be halved by this date, when currently they're on course to rise by 15%. Australia, for example, set out a new 2050 net zero carbon target this week, but did not make a headline commitment for this decade. As hosts of COP26, the United Kingdom has a significant role of encouraging and negotiating pledges from almost 200 countries, with many developing nations arguing developed nations have a responsibility to do much more, as they have already profited from causing historical carbon emissions. After the world leaders' meeting, over the next few days, negotiators will work on text with the hope of reaching a deal by 12th of November. Boris Johnson may come back to the summit in Glasgow towards the end if it looks like an agreement may be within touching distance. Under prospects of a deal that keeps to 1.5 degrees Celsius, Boris Johnson said, "It's nip and tuck, it's touch and go. We could do it or we could fail by the middle of November." Following the G20 summit, there was a sense of disappointment and some trepidation from No. 10 Downing Street about the outcome of the Glasgow summit. although the Labour Party has accused the government of deliberately lowering expectations in order to declare victory if there is only a modestly improved deal at the end. Speaking at a press conference, Boris Johnson said pledges from countries to lower their emissions needed to be stronger. Experts believe that for 1.5 degrees Celsius rise to have a chance of success, countries need to make substantial and meaningful pledges of reductions by 2030 as well. Johnson also asked for promises on phasing out coal, the move to electric vehicles, and an end to deforestation and finance, pledges of money to help developing nations deal with a climate emergency. The countries most responsible for historical and present-day emissions are not yet doing their fair share of the work, Boris Johnson said. If we're going to prevent COP26 from being a failure, then that must change, and I must be clear that if Glasgow fails, then the whole thing fails. The Paris Agreement will have crumpled at the first reckoning. At the Paris Climate Accord made in 2015, world leaders committed to keeping the global temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius, or as close to 1.5 degrees Celsius as possible. Boris Johnson said that agreement, and the hope that came with it, is currently just a piece of paper, which needed to be filled with granular pledges from every country.